Well, welcome. For those of you who aren't familiar with these nights, what we're doing basically on these nights is we're taking in and looking at various realities of who God is and the way he interacts with us and how we relate to him. And we're looking at him through teaching, but then also through worship, with a definite focus on the worship. And tonight we're focusing on the aspect of the holiness of God, which is a very, always an interesting topic, because it's one of those topics that we hear often enough that we stop listening when we hear it, and we sing it often enough that we stop thinking about it when we sing it, and we talk about it often enough that we stop thinking about it when we talk about it. So tonight I really want to reopen some things about holiness and what it really means that God is holy. I've got just a whole lot going through my mind right now, and yeah, I had a tough time writing any notes for tonight, so we'll see how it goes, because I've got so many things burning in my mind that are, you know, the depths of God's desire toward us is just a reality that won't let go of me. The idea of our calling in God and what it is, and just the reality of intercession and the reality of eternity, all these things are going through my mind, and so I'm teaching about holiness. And hopefully, by the end, we'll actually have some idea of why those things are actually connected, but we'll see. But what's really been on my heart for the last few weeks is just this whole idea of resolving the differences between the way we live and the things that we say we believe. Because it's so easy to let those things slip by, you know, that we all know that we don't actually live according to the things that we think we believe, that our lives as they are don't perfectly line up with everything that we say we believe, with everything that we read in the Bible that we believe on some level. And yet our lives don't line up with that. We don't see those realities in our lives. And the temptation there is to get frustrated that, you know, we see how it's supposed to be and we're not there. And so the temptation is to get frustrated and to think we're failing. Or the temptation is to go and try and control what it is that we do. But what's so important to understand is how much what we believe affects the way we live. How much, you know, it says in the Bible that the mouth speaks out of the abundance of the heart. In other words, what's in our hearts, what's in the depths of us, what we really believe is what determines the way that we live and the way we respond to the world around us. And so for me, when I see things about the way I live that don't line up with the things that I say I believe, my immediate response that I desire, the response that I want to have, is, okay, do I really believe that? And if I really believe it, why do I believe it? In other words, you know, when I'm walking around the world and I'm in this world and I go through a day and it's just another day and I don't see the world as something that is so far away from God's holiness and God's perfection and his perfect desires for it, right? I want that to bother me. I want to immediately, that burns in my heart, and I go back and I start to just stare in the Bible at the reality of God's holiness and the beauty of holiness. That's the phrase that has caught my heart for the last couple of weeks, is that phrase from Psalms where it says that we worship him in the beauty of holiness. And I have no idea what that means, the beauty of holiness. And so that's what I'm searching out tonight, is what is the beauty of holiness? So much of the time when we think of holiness, we're not thinking of beauty. We think it's difficult, or it's impossible, or it's hard to reach, or sometimes rather aggravating. Holiness is our enemy, right? It's something we're striving to get, but we can't see it. We can't get there. But the Bible calls holiness beautiful. It calls God's holiness beautiful. And by looking at the beauty of God, it begins to change the way that we see the world. Because when we understand the beauty of God, we understand just how far away from God we are. A lot of the times it takes something really bad in order to kind of shock us into the reality that the world needs God. When the truth of it is that every day should remind us that the world needs God. Every day should remind us that we need God. Because every day of our lives, even our best days, are just impossibly far from the perfection of God and the perfection of holiness. And when we actually start to look at just the beauty of God and what holiness actually means, we start to realize that our worst days, when the worst things happen to us, or when we fail, the worst we've ever failed, God doesn't even see that. I mean, that's so imperceptibly small compared to the huge gap that's between us and God to begin with, that he doesn't even see those things. And so there's every bit as much hope for us on those days as there is on our best days. But I'm just stuck on this whole reality of resolving the differences between the way that I live and what I say I believe. And there's really only two ways to go about that. You either start changing the way you act, which is good, but a lot of the times we can't do that. Or you start changing what you believe. In other words, we start looking and we look for the root of the problem. Right? When I don't act the way that I think I want to act, why is that? You know, what part of me somewhere still is holding on to something that's less than truth? What part of me somewhere still doesn't have that right understanding of what life is like and what God is all about? I think, you know, and a lot of times I refer to them as wrong beliefs, but really what they are is just more of an absence of right convictions. When we really start to get the conviction on our heart that God is holy, that he is so incredibly beautiful and so incredibly perfect, that he is entirely light and there is no shadow in him, that starts to change the way we live. It starts to change the way we pray and the way we talk to God. Because when we start to understand, when we have a real heart conviction that God is perfection defined, then when we look around and see even the slightest thing that's off, we know we can ask him to fix it, and he'll fix it. You know, he's not just a crisis solver God. He's not just a God who comes in and salvages a little good out of a large area of darkness. As you know, I've been focusing on the area of intercession lately, and that's just what has struck me about my own intercession, is that so much of the time I'm praying to God and I'm asking him, God, could you save a little good out of this bad situation? Or could you make this bad situation, you know, a little better? Could you come and save one thing out of this dark world, when we don't understand that God is perfection and he is all powerful and he is fully capable of completely transforming realities and completely turning around nations and completely changing everything about our life and the way we live? And when we get a hold of a vision of God that captures his beauty like that, then we see everything as being in need of God, and we start living in that reality of continual prayer, where it says to pray continually. We start living in that reality because we see everything, and we see, you know, how much better this could be if God was in it. Everything that we go through and everything that we do, we see how much better it could be if God was in it. So to just really start looking at, you know, what do we understand of God's holiness, or do we understand God's holiness? And to start staring at that is what I want to do tonight. You know, it says in 2 Corinthians 10, verses 4 and 5, that our weapons are for the tearing down of strongholds, for those things, those false things that set themselves up against the knowledge of God. Right, that we've been given the weapons of the Word and of the Spirit to go in our minds and deliberately tear down those things that have set themselves up against the knowledge of God, those misunderstandings about who he is, those wrong ideas we have about who God is and what he's like, to just go and tear all those barriers down so that we can really look at him the way he is. And the great thing about this understanding that that what we believe determines what we do, and how important it is to focus on what we believe about God and what we see about God, is that there's zero condemnation in understanding that we have a lot of wrong mindsets about God, because that's just the way we are. Right, the process of our salvation is correcting all those mindsets. Romans 12, 1 and 2, that our minds are renewed and transformed, that he brings us from the place of all these misunderstandings about who he is and everything that that does to our life. He brings us into a renewed and transformed mind. And then the promise of that is that then you will know the good, perfect, and pleasing will of the Father. In other words, you will know exactly what you're supposed to do in every situation. When your mind becomes transformed and you start to actually see God for who he is, we start to see things as they are. And the beauty of that is, and this is what is so great about our calling, you know, that when it says the hope of our calling in Ephesians 1, this to me is what the hope of our calling is. That our full-time occupation is meant to be gazing on God. Right, when we begin to understand that what happens in our minds and in our hearts determines how we behave, then our full-time occupation is no longer trying to grab hold of our tongue and keep it in check. It's no longer trying to force ourselves to go and do things for God because he wants us to be out evangelizing or he wants us to be out discipling. It's standing in the presence of God, gazing on his beauty, and then that transforms us. 2 Corinthians 3:18. As we gaze on his beauty, it transforms us into his image. And so our full-time occupation as believers is just gazing upon the beauty of God. And as we do that, it does things to us that make us live differently, that make us see the world differently. And all of the stuff that he calls us to do begins to become a natural overflow of our lives. And so that's the introduction. But the subject of holiness is one of those areas that so much of the time we don't gaze at. You know, that song we were singing, that I want to live as a child in awe of you. You know, how much of the time do we actually live in awe of God? Right, most of the time we live maybe slightly in fear of God, occasionally aware that he's around. You know, looking at his commandments, we see they're really hard. And so he must be slightly different than us because he's asking us to do things that we can't figure out how to do. But how often do we live in awe of God, in awe of his beauty? How often are we actually living just struck by the beauty and the holiness of God? Because that's the way we were meant to live the whole time. That's the way we are meant to live always. We're meant to live constantly in awe of God and just struck by his beauty and his glory and hopelessly in love with him. And because of that, then we start to live the way we're called to live. You know, when God created us, he created us to be in his presence. You know, of all the creatures on the earth, we're the ones that are said to be created in his image. And what that means is that we're created with the unique capacity to actually be around God and to understand God. You know, we're the only creature that has a heart, mind, and soul that we could love God with. No other creature even has that. They don't have the capability of loving God. They don't have the capability of seeing how awesome he is and falling in love with him. We were designed for that. We were created specifically for that purpose. And that was a big rabbit trail. Okay. But holiness is... The other reason why I want to talk about holiness is because it's so important that we understand God's holiness in order to understand the way that he acts in our lives. Because God's holiness is one of our biggest objections to receiving God's love. You know, we talked about that last week, how difficult it is for us to receive God's love. How many things there are that get in the way of us understanding and receiving God's desire for us. The fact that he has a love for each one of us individually, and that he's reaching out in that love, and he has a desire to bring us into his presence and to spend time with us and to be near to us. And the human mind has so many objections against that. And one of them is God's holiness. Because to us, so much of the time, his holiness and his love seem at odds. You know, his holiness says that we have to stay far away from him. His love says we're supposed to come close to him. You know, which is it? And the reality is it's both. And when we begin to understand both, his love has a whole new meaning to it in light of his holiness, and his holiness has a whole new meaning to it in light of his love. We're going to be looking tonight in the worship specifically at just the revelation that God gave to John in Revelation chapter 4 and 5, and just that drama that plays out there. And it's so incredible because it's, I mean, what God does to John there is just amazing. He brings him to this reality of his holiness with all this crazy stuff going on around to display God's holiness. And then right in the middle of that drama, you know, he up and shows John this scroll. And he asks the question, you know, who can come and open the scroll? Right, and heaven doesn't need to ask that question. Heaven knows the answer to that question. They know that there is no one worthy to come and take from the Father's hand the scroll, which is, you know, the unsealing of the final things, what would bring to pass the final consummation of everything that was done on earth in bringing God and man back together again. Heaven doesn't need to ask that because heaven knows, and yet it says that they search through all of heaven and all of earth and they can't find anyone. Right, they're not searching because they think they might find someone. They know there's no one there. It's all a drama for John's eyes. And by the end of it, John is just weeping that there is no one worthy to take the scroll. There is no one worthy to bring man back into the presence of God in holiness. And then out comes the Lamb. And John sees the Lamb. And he hears all heaven cry, "Worthy is the Lamb. He is worthy to take the scroll and open its seals, because he has redeemed man to God." And that whole drama of God's holiness, just standing there in stark contrast to man, and just the realization of how far man is from God's holiness, and how desperate our situation was, and that there is no one able to bridge that gap, then gives a whole new meaning to the love that Jesus showed on the cross when he bridged that gap and he made possible bringing us into the presence of God. But the other thing I want to look at tonight, before even getting to that, is just this whole calling that we have to be in the presence of God and in the presence of holiness. It's really important that we understand that God's holiness at the fall in Genesis demanded that he would be separated from men. Right? And he had the option there that he could have just up and left the Garden of Eden and left man living in paradise for the rest of his days, but without the presence of God. God had that option. We see in Exodus when the Israelites build the golden calf while Moses is up on the mountain getting the Ten Commandments, God is so angry that first he threatens to destroy them. But then he says, you know what? I love you. I give you my blessing. You can go into Israel, but I'm not going with you because I'm holy. And if I go with you, you're going to do something that angers me and I'm going to destroy you. And I can't stand to do that. So God has the option, when man sins and falls, that he can just remove himself from us. And we can go on in the rest of our days with no problems, living for ourselves in paradise. But God doesn't take that option, because God's love demands that we be in his presence. It demands that we be fully restored to holiness in his presence, so that we could once again stand before him unashamed. That we can once again stand before him in complete and perfect love. And so the whole drama of the cross, all the pain that it cost God at the cross, and all the pain that it cost him just as time goes by and he sees the world the way it is, getting darker and darker and darker, all of that God chooses to go through. Because in the end reality, he wants people rejoined with him in that perfect unity of us standing in his presence in the beauty of his holiness. And that's really important to understand when we look at our own lives, that God has a vision for us that goes beyond this life. That God has a vision for us for all of eternity. Right? When he created you, he wasn't just thinking of what things you could do while you were on this earth for 70 or 80 or 90 years or whatever it is. When he created you, he was thinking of that reality of you standing before him for all of eternity, gazing on his beauty, receiving his love, and returning your love to him. And that's what he's after. And so when we see things in this life that don't seem to line up with God's love, it's because God's love is so much bigger than what we're thinking. It's because God's love is a love that lasts for all eternity, and he's looking at the eternal picture. And so he does things that don't make sense. And what kicked off this whole train of thought for me is a story in Exodus chapter 4, which just makes no sense from a human perspective. It's Exodus 4, verses 24 through 26. And the story is God and Moses. And Moses has just had the burning bush encounter. He's just had an encounter with God where he's seen him appear in the bush. And then the Lord appears to Moses again as he's traveling to Egypt, as he's doing what God commanded him to do. And it says, "And it came to pass on the way at the encampment that the Lord met him and sought to kill him. Then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at Moses' feet and said, 'Surely you are a husband of blood to me.' And so God let him go. And then she said, 'You are a husband of blood because of the circumcision.'" So this random little three-verse passage in Exodus, God's trying to kill Moses. Right? And to our mind, that makes no sense. Why is a God of love trying to kill Moses, whom he just commanded to go to Egypt, and Moses is doing exactly that? But what God has in mind for Moses is so much bigger than that. Moses is getting ready to be the leader of the Israelites. But more than that, Moses is about to become one of the people who have more encounter with God than anyone else in the history of the Bible. He has on Mount Sinai in Exodus chapter 19, he goes up into the cloud of the glory of the Lord and receives the Ten Commandments. He's there in the presence of the Lord for 40 days and for 40 nights. In Exodus 33, it says that Moses used to go to the tent of meeting, and every time he would go there, the presence of the Lord would descend in a cloud at the entrance to the tent, and God would speak to him face to face, as a man speaks to a friend. So what God's doing in Exodus 4 is preparing Moses. Look, Moses, you're about to encounter holiness in a way that no one ever has before you and no one ever will again. You're about to go into my presence on a regular and consistent basis, and you need to understand what that means. That I am a holy God, and the only thing that enables you to come into my presence is the covenant of love that I've given you, and that at the time was circumcision. And Moses had chosen to ignore that with his son. So God is preparing Moses for a lifetime of encounter. And that event is so insignificant to Moses in light of the way his life goes that Moses, who wrote the book of Exodus, gives it three verses. He makes no attempt to explain why God was trying to kill him. He makes no attempt to justify what he had done. He just says, "The Lord tried to kill me, and then I circumcised my son, and he let me go." Because the things in Moses' life after that are so much bigger and so much greater that that event meant nothing. And that's what Paul's talking about when he's talking about these momentary and light afflictions that mean nothing compared to the eternal weight of glory that God is working in us. And when we have that kind of mindset, it changes the way we live. It changes the way we view what circumstances that happen to us. That God is working in us something eternal. That He is preparing us for our eternal occupation of standing in the presence of holiness. Of gazing on His beauty and of falling hopelessly in love with Him and giving our love to Him. And the last encounter I want to look at is Isaiah's in chapter 6 of Isaiah. Isaiah sees the holiness of the Lord. He sees the Lord on His throne. It says, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of His robe filled the temple. Above it stood seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one cried to another and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory.' And the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke." And so I said, "Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." So Isaiah sees the holiness of the Lord, and the effect that it has on him is, "Woe is me, I am undone, for I have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." He stands in the presence of holiness, and the effect it has on him is it immediately reveals his own unholiness. It immediately reveals how far away he is from God. But then in verse 6, it says, "One of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a live coal which he had taken with the tongs from the altar, and he touched my mouth with it and said, 'Behold, this has touched your lips, your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is purged.'" And so the atonement from the altar purges that sin, and Isaiah is allowed to stand in the presence of the Lord and to gaze on His face. You notice in verse 2, the seraphim, these angelic creatures, are covering their faces. They can't bear to look on the holiness of God, and yet Isaiah is there staring at Him. Do you realize that we have the honor of staring at the beauty of the Lord that even angelic beings can't handle? The Lord brings Isaiah into His presence, lets him see His face, and says the atonement of the altar has covered that. You know, in Exodus, the Lord told him, "No man can see my face or he will surely die." And that's why Isaiah is freaking out. "I've just seen the face of the Lord. I'm a dead man." And the Lord comes to him and says, "No, the atonement of the altar covers that. You are allowed into my presence. You are invited into my presence. Come and gaze at my holiness. Come and see what no one has ever seen before." And what John sees in Revelation is the fulfillment of that. Right? He sees the same thing played out, only it's new covenant now. He sees the holiness of God, and then he sees that there's no way that man can ever get there, that no way that man could ever get into the throne room of God, could ever stand in the presence of that holiness, could ever reach to that holiness. And then the Lord comes and says, "No, the atonement has covered that. You are invited into my presence. The atonement of the Lamb slain from before the foundation of the world, has covered your sins. And you are now invited into the presence of holiness to gaze on me." You know, it says, "Worthy is the Lamb, because he has made us a kingdom of priests before our God." In other words, we're all invited now into the presence of God to stand in the presence of holiness. So, if somebody wants to grab those handouts, actually, I have handouts, but they have nothing to do with the teaching. They're for the worship. just the scriptures that we're going to be focusing on during the worship time, just so you have those in front of you and you don't have to be flipping around, because it gets really distracting for you if you have to keep trying to look things up and figure out where we're at. But what we're going to be looking at in the time of worship is just progressing through that drama of Revelation 4 and 5 and just trying to understand something of what's going on in heaven. Because it's interesting to me that what John writes down, we know that's so far short of what he actually saw and felt and heard. That when he tries to describe the Lord's beauty and he says it's like a jasper or a sardius stone, right, he's just doing the best he can. That has nothing to do with what it actually looked like. And what he's actually seeing there is not jewels, not physical beauty. What he's actually seeing is he's seeing in the spirit realm the beauty of God's holiness. You know, he's seeing holiness. And of course, there's no words to say what holiness looks like. And so there's these little images to try and give us an idea. But what's actually going on in heaven is so much bigger than that. It's just beyond understanding. So we want to just try to enter into that drama some. When John goes up into heaven and sees the holiness of the Lord. So the first section we're going to focus on is just this reality that God is holy. And he's holy beyond anything we can imagine. He is perfection. He is beauty. He is pure light. And then from there it moves to this reality that if God is holy, then we are infinitely separated from him. He is so far above. There's this huge gap between God and man that no one in heaven or on earth is able to bridge. But then finally, just the reality of God's invitation to draw near to holiness. Right? When the Lamb of God appears and he says, "No, look, the Lamb has overcome. And you are invited into my holiness now. You are invited into my presence. You're invited to stand in the presence of holiness and to gaze on the beauty of holiness." And that's God's plan for all of eternity, is to draw us into his presence, to draw us into the presence of holiness. It calls him the Lamb slain from before the foundation of the world, which fascinates me, that Jesus was the Lamb slain before the world was ever created, before man ever fell, before there was ever a need for redemption. It wasn't a backup plan. It wasn't a things got out of hand, let's get things back in control. God planned for all of eternity for the fallen redemption of man, so that he could have man drawn into his presence, so that we could come from where we're at down here, far away from his presence, and we could feel him and see him reach out to us and pull us up into the presence of holiness. You know, the angels have been in the presence of holiness all their life. They are surrounded by holiness. They can see it in a way that none of us can. Right? Right now, they're there. They're in the presence of holiness. And so for them, there is no choice to love God. I mean, when you're standing there in the presence of holiness, the only thing they can do is continuously fall over and say, "Holy, holy, holy." They don't have any choice in the matter. But us down here on the earth, we can't see that most of the time. We have to choose to gaze into it. And we have to choose to focus our hearts and our minds on God and to pour out our love on him in that way. And that's what God is looking for in man. He's looking for voluntary lovers. He's looking for the choice to stand before him and worship him. You know, when it says, when Jesus died on the cross, that the curtain was torn that separates God and man, the curtain of the holy place, right, that separated the presence of God in the most holy place from all of man on the outside. It's interesting that the curtain was only torn. It was torn in two, meaning anyone now has access to the most holy place, to the presence of God, to the beauty of his holiness. But the curtain didn't fall away. It's not that God dropped the curtain and said to man, look, here I am, gaze on me. He made us a path. He made us a way into the presence of holiness. When it says in Ephesians 3, verse 12, that in Jesus Christ, we can approach God in freedom and confidence. He made a way. He made a path for us to enter into the presence of holiness and for us to draw near to a holy God. But it's still our choice to do that. And so tonight, we just want to make that choice, to just focus our minds on the holiness of God, to just focus our minds on Him and just allowing Him to blow our minds with how beautiful He is so that we can worship Him and love Him better. Right? To just shock us with how amazing He is and everything that He's done so that we have more content to worship Him and love Him with. And so I'll just encourage you that, you know, as we look at the holiness of God, to allow it to go beyond anywhere that it's ever gone before in your mind. You know, in other words, to drop the ideas that we have of what holiness means and to just stare for a while at God and who He is, which is the definition of holiness. God is holiness defined. Everything that He is what holiness is. So let's go ahead and go into time of worship and just ask the Lord to just show up and to shock us with His beauty.